Holy God, grant us the beginning of wisdom and love to cast out every fear, that we may grow more brave, more ready to hear, more ready to obey. In the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. We come to a pivotal point in the Gospel of Mark in our lesson this morning. The word I have seen utilized most often in describing this reading calls it the hinge text of the entire gospel. Until this point in the narrative, Jesus has begun his public ministry and has traveled throughout Galilee, preaching, teaching, healing, and performing miracles. His true identity has only been hinted at. Of course, we, the readers, know who Jesus really is, as is directly stated in the opening line of the gospel, chapter 1, verse 1. The beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. But within the context of the narrative itself, the true identity of Jesus is never addressed so directly until now. The only entities who have testified to Jesus' true heritage have been the demons and unclean spirits he has exorcised. And he immediately rebuked them and commanded them all to silence before dispatching. This reading is considered a hinge because after this encounter today and the story of the transfiguration which immediately follows it and occurs 6 days later in the context of the narrative, Jesus' ministry, focus, and travels all change. We will see fewer miracles and healings and more teachings and parables. The focus of the teaching concentrates more on discipleship, what it is, the commitment it requires, the cost it may demand. And his road now leads to Jerusalem, that his ministry and mission may be completed. Of course, the disciples remain obstinate and often clueless students throughout, even when Jesus speaks to them plainly and openly, as he does today. We will journey with Jesus and the disciples on their way to Jerusalem for the next 6 weeks. We will conclude this section, two chapters in Mark, the last Sunday in October, with the healing of blind Bartimaeus as Jesus arrives in Jerusalem just for the account of his triumphal entry. Our reading today begins with Jesus and the disciples on the way to the area around Caesarea Philippi, an area about 25 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. It sits at the headwaters of the River Jordan in the mountains that stretch through modern-day Israel, Lebanon, and Syria. Although a Roman settlement in Jesus' time, the Greeks had built a large temple to the god Pan there much earlier. While on their way, walking, of course, Jesus questions his disciples. Who do people say that I am? They give varied responses. John the Baptist, Elijah, a prophet. We can see from these responses that the public and the disciples understand that Jesus is indeed a special kind of person. But who do you say that I am? He asks in follow-up. He now puts this much more focused question to his closest associates, those who have traveled with him, have witnessed his miracles, listened to his teaching, and taking part in his private discussion. Who do you say? Peter apparently answers without hesitation. You are the Messiah. This is the first instance of a human witness to the truth in the gospel. One might expect that Jesus would respond rather positively to this response, as he does in the account in Matthew, but instead he sternly orders them to silence. Jesus then shares with them the first of his three passion predictions, gently explaining to them what lay ahead for him as he turns toward Jerusalem, that he must undergo great suffering, betrayal, rejection, humiliation, torture, and execution. that he may rise after 3 days. This is simply too much for Peter, who takes Jesus aside and rebukes him. A rebuke is a reprimand or a criticism or even a scolding. Here we have Peter, who only moments before acclaimed Jesus as the Messiah, now upbraiding his teacher for explaining what the Messiah must face. It reveals that while Peter has gotten the answer to the question right, he really doesn't understand what the answer means. The concept of the Messiah was a well-known thought in Jewish thought. It usually centered around an image of a David-like person who would be a warrior king and would restore Israel to its independence and its greatness. The idea of a suffering and executed servant was not part of that expectation. Peter is apparently quite certain that Jesus misunderstands his role. Jesus turns to the disciples, and in front of them, he rebukes Peter right back with a statement that must have struck Peter like a brutal slap across the face. "Get behind me, Satan," he tells Peter. "You are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human." The gospel message throughout is always a radical upsetting of the status quo, a reversal of expectation and an exaltation of the unexpected. It shuns the rich and powerful in favor of the poor, the outcast, and the marginal. It often seems a complete contradiction of all we may find humanly rational. The first shall be last, and the last shall be first. Those who save their life will lose it, and those who lose it will save it. The Messiah must undergo great suffering and be executed, that the reality and power of his mission may be fulfilled and revealed. This radical understanding of Jesus has often been tamed by the centuries, by habit, by media representations, and by its prevalence, even permeation of our particular culture. Like Peter and the rest of the disciples, we often cannot see what may be right in front of us. Our very human expectations, our fears and confusion, obstruct our ability to comprehend and embrace. But, like Peter, Jesus always calls us back to set our mind on divine things, not human.